This week is Parshat Vayigash, as we move towards the end of Sefer Bereishit. And I want to talk about Yosef. And I say Yosef, I don't necessarily mean Yosef as opposed to Tzafnat Paneah. And I think that there is some intrigue that needs to be clarified between the difference between the two of them. Because are they in reality one person or two people? And I'm not trying to confuse any of you. What I'm trying to say is how much of a course reference, and was there between the two? Just for example, when we're told that the brothers come and they see Yosef, and Yosef remembers the dreams, and they all bow down. So it's possible. Again, I'm making all this up, but it's possible. Did they bow down to Yosef, or did they bow down to Tzafnat Paneach? Which is Yosef's dreams were that they would bow down to him, but did they bow down to him in that moment, or did they bow down to somebody else? Which means It's complicated because, you know, one of the things they hear the dreams, Hamloch Tumloch Banu, Hamshol Tumshol Banu, and it's there that we have the distinction between a melech versus a moshal. A melech is somebody who's accepted, who's anointed. Therefore, in Rosh Hashanah, we anoint God. Ki la Hashem Amlucha u'moshel bagayim. God is a king, but he's a dictator. He's a ruler by others. So now we have this great philosophical question. Yosef, and I'm not going to, you know, nitpick this, you know, were they all there, and Binyamin wasn't there, and his father wasn't there, and his mother was dead. They all bowed down to him. They bowed down to his economic superiority, and they bowed down to him as being a leader. So did the dreams just come true? Or the fact they don't know that they're bowing down to him means they're not bowing down to him. They're bowing down to some Egyptian guy. So therefore, you know, I guess it's sort of like the tree falling in the forest kind of thing. Or like if a husband says something and his wife isn't there to correct him, is he still wrong?
Yes.
So if you bow down to Yosef, but you don't know it's Yosef, so did you bow down to Yosef? You bow down to somebody else. So I'm just trying to point out that there are these two different people over here. I mean, of course, the two different people are the same people. I know they're the same people, right? But there are two different people. There is this public persona who's called Tzafnat Paneach, and then there is this person named Yosef. There's a brilliant comment of Yosef Karo. And someone listening who's really educated is going to correct me and say, no, it's not Rav Yosef's Karo commentary. It's of Yitzchak Karo, wrote a commentary on Chumash, which is much more famous. He was his uncle. But Rav Yosef Karo really wrote what I'm about to say. So don't correct me. And that is, he says that Yosef immediately accuses the brothers of being spies so that they couldn't question, who is this guy? Like, what's his backstory? Where did he come from? What makes him tick? I mean, if you have an adversary, you want to do as much information gathering about them, correct, as you possibly can. So how does Yosef stop them from doing research by saying, you guys are spies? And then as soon as they start asking questions, you see, they're spies. So therefore, it was this brilliant move of Yosef. And by the way, that's what we're all going to see today. We're going to see brilliant moves of Yosef. Of course, the only question is, how many of these are imaginary and how many of these are real? I actually started a class yesterday, and I do this not out of complete narcissism, but I started a class yesterday by saying that either Yosef was completely brilliant or I am. So, which means either I figured out what Yosef is trying to do, or I'm just imagining it all, and then I came up with this whole plan. And one of the reasons I do this is to catch their attention, and then for them to catch me and, you know, start looking and trying to figure out, you know, where I'm wrong, because students love to do that. We're going to see some of the things here that Yosef does, and we have to, you know, think about that, and especially about implications of it. So, starting with source number one, which is moving towards the end of the parasha, Vayalkeit Yosef et kol hakesef hanimtza be'eretz Mitzrayim ve'eretz Kanan b'shever asher hem shovrim. He has now, you know, we had our 7 good years and then our 7 bad years, and we're moving along in the 7 bad years, and during this time, everyone's got to pay for food. So Yosef is now, by this point, has collected all of the money. All of the money. Now, given events which have taken place recently, especially in America, but the truth is just America has caught up a little bit with other places, like France and England and South Africa and so on, in terms of violence and anti-Semitic actions which are taking place. I just wonder how this read in the Egyptian newspaper. Yosef has collected all the money. Yosef controls the banks, right? So, but again, this goes back to my introduction. Is it Yosef who controls the banks? Or is it Tzafnat Paneach? And is Tzafnat Paneach really secretive? Do they know who he is? Again, the name, Tzafnat Paneach, there's an argument if it's a Hebrew name or if it's an Egyptian name. If it's a Hebrew name, so it has to do with secrets. So do people really know who he is or not? of course, in the dark web, they all know who he is, and they figured it out. And because even if he wasn't Jewish, they would say that he was Jewish because he controls the banks. And you realize, once I start like this, this is not going to work out well, right? You all realize this is not going to have a happy ending over here, right? Right. So let's continue then. V'yaveh Yosef a kesef beit paro, and he brings it to the house of Paro. V'yitom a kesef eretz Mitzrayim beretz Kanan, v'yavok Mitzrayim el Yosef leimor, havol lanu lechem v'lama namut negdecha ki afes kesef. You know, we're all going to die. There's no money left. V'yomu Yosef havu miknechem. So then bring your flock, which is also interesting because we never really knew to what extent the Egyptians had flocks, because that was one of the things that seemed to be a point of sensitivity in terms of the brothers being shepherds. Well, bring your flocks over. Okay, great. And we'll also have to worry or wonder about the implications of it. Itin lem Yosef lechem bas susim. That's also interesting that they have susim and they have mikneh and they have tzon. We'll see later a targum that says something about the susim. We will come back to that. It could be man doesn't live on meat alone. I mean, you also don't have refrigeration. And okay, you salt, you put it away. You probably have a limited shelf life. That's it, I would assume. And if I'm correct, you know, reading between the lines of the Gemara, when it talks about the meals they used to have, they would make some kind of a soup or a broth, but the main part of the meal was the bread. They would take the bread and they would dip it in and they would eat the bread. They got filled up on bread more than they got filled up on other things. And that's why, you know, bread is the central part of the meal. I really don't imagine that they just filled up on steak or things like that. They made things out of it, but then they mainly ate the bread. And that's been suggested is part of the sensitivity with the animals, is maybe they also were worshipping some of these things and so on. Let's continue. Actually, a lot of issues having to do with ancient Egyptology. I've discussed with a fellow named Michael, who's come to the shir a couple of times. He had a stroke a couple of weeks ago, so he should have a refuah shleima, and the things we learned should be in his merit, and we'll hope to go visit him next week. We should charge for shout-outs. This right? So as the time goes on, Pasuk Yutet, Lama Namud, again this happens in the next year, and by this point they have no money, and so what happens? They have no flocks. So Pasuk Yutet, Lama Namud Leinecha, Gam Anachnu, Gam Admateinu, Kana Otanu Ve'et Admateinu Balachem. Now the people make this offer, please buy us, buy our lands, because you'd rather be alive than dead. V'admateinu avadim l'paro, v'tein zera v'nichyeh v'lo namut, v'adama lo toshem. Better than the land becoming destroyed and us dead, you know, paro should buy everything. V'ikein Yosef kol admat Mitzrayim. So by this point, he's not only controls all of the money, now he controls all the real estate. So I guess it's also a Jewish thing that we have the real estate, we have the... But that doesn't make a difference. It really doesn't, because you always blame the Jews when you can. So... V'tihi ha'aretz l'paro. V'ta'am hivir ato l'arim, miktzei gvul Mitzrayim v'ad katzeo. So it's also interesting, and the populations got moved along the way, which is always interesting in terms of antiquity. Rak admat ha'kohenim lo kanan. Now, by the way, it's interesting back in Pasuk Yotet, v'tein zera v'nichye v'lo namud. Give us things to plant. But there was no planting going on during this time, so what value? I mean, just think about the trade that he made. Okay, we'll give you things to plant, but we're taking your land. And... The whole thing is not as clear to me. I know what the result is at the end. No, but you can't. But there's a drought. So planting is not going to help.
I don't understand.
Could be the Nile has, or whatever it was, has dried. So, but there is one exception to this, and what's the exception is the Kohanim ve'ta'amivir otamarim mikzegvul mitzrayim ve'adkotzei urak admata Kohanim lo kana ki chok lo Kohanim me'et paro. So it's also interesting there. It says that Paro has made this law that. With the Kohanim, is there are different rules. That they have special rules. Who are the Kohanim? Rashi tells us that they are what we would call the priests. They are the people involved in religious activity. Hakomarim koloshon kohen misharet lelo hutu. It is always religious functionaries is what a Kohen is. Chutz meotam shem lashon gedula. Meaning it's always this except for this, which you don't love when things are written like this. Except for those that aren't, and those are positions of power, Kimo, Kohen Midian, and Kohen On. So you realize what Rashi just now did. What are his exceptions? His exceptions are the various fathers-in-law of Moshe and of Yosef. No, those, you know, they didn't marry daughters of priests, right? Rather, they married daughters of powerful people, of wealthy people, which is also something to write down in the resume. Like, what are you looking for? Right. No. Okay. But it is interesting, because how do we know? How do we know what Yitro was? Was Yitro somebody from, was it religious, or was Yitro somebody of power, or for that matter, what about Potiphar? Or Potipharah? Okay, let's move on. In source number 4, the Hadar Zakenim, and as we read some of these commentaries, you know, the challenge of all of us when we learn is always to take our knowledge, our experiences, our frames of reference, and then read them back on ancient sources and try to understand what was going on there. But sometimes we can't help it because we're coming from our points of knowledge. So you also wonder to what extent we're going to read people in the Middle Ages, or are they thinking about the power structures which existed then and then reading them back, and or to what extent they have evidence that this is how things operated then. So the Hadar Zakenim is a collection of writings from the Balei HaTosfot. Kichok l'kohanim. So go towards the end there, where it's underlined. No, let's read the whole thing, because it's amazing. Midrash, Bishvil Shei Sayu LiYosef. Now, right there, I just have to point out, as far as I can tell, he's ignoring the Pshat, because the Pshat said it was Paro's call. He says, no, because they helped Yosef. Kishiratzu Lahamlich Yosef. Now, this is also interesting, because Yosef was not really kinged, right? He was appointed as... Well, that's also interesting what Yosef's real role was. So we'll have some, hopefully, some discussion about that. What was really his role? I mean, as far as we know, it was economic, and he was in charge. He was Minister of Agriculture. I mean, that's a treasury. You want to go to treasury already? Okay. Kishirat zlamlich Yosef, amru hamitzrim, eich namlich isha shachavit eshet adonav. How couldn't he go and hire somebody, make him a king, somebody who slept with his master's wife? Now, what's the problem with Eshet Adonav? Is it a moral issue? Or is it the problem that he was a slave, that he had an Adonav? Which means, where is the problem? Is that Egypt is so moral that they don't like people that sleep with people other than, right? I mean, but other people can do that. Okay. Continue. I mean, the Paros did marry their sisters, by the way. We're not dealing with... I always thought it was interesting when Avraham comes down, and who's that? That's my sister. Being your sister doesn't preclude that it's your wife. I mean, this is when you're talking to an Egyptian, especially an Egyptian king, that's just a real interesting turn of phrase there. So they had this problem. Omulei hakomarim ra'u efo bigdo nikra. Let's go do an investigation. So now they all become Sherlock Holmes over here. And let's go take a look and say, which way was it ripped? Im nikrame achorav, it was ripped from behind. B'yedua, shelo ratza levo aleha, elokishabarach karato eshet adonav. That he didn't want to be with her, and therefore it was ripped in a place that he was trying to run away, and she was trying to hold him back. Im nikra lefanav, but it was ripped in the front. Then you'll know. By the way, what really happened? Yosef ran away. Nonetheless, the Midrash, which is once it's on a roll here, it goes, Batku matzua kriyam alacharav, ki Gavriel hafcha vamlichu, because Gavriel turned it around. Why did Gavriel have to turn it around? Because he was trying to run away. So I am somewhat mystified. V'yesha omrim ki chok l'kohanim l'fi shahoyu krovei ishto, v'ishto hayta bat potifera kohen on, v'oto ha-kohanim krovim hayu. So he gives a second interpretation, is that all of this is nepotism. It's nepotism because this is family, because you have all of these ruling families in Egypt who are related to one another. So essentially, you know, how does he show up by the family Thanksgiving dinner if he didn't hook up all of his wife's uncles and so on? And after having said this, he writes, the Lo Nehira. I don't agree with what I just now wrote. I don't agree with what I just now cited. V'lo Nehira li, d'huk tiv kichok l'koni me'et paro. Alma, de paro natan lehem achol kvar. that this is Paro's doing, it has nothing to do with Yosef. So after going through all of these machinations, exactly, and what Yosef was planning and plotting and doing and so on, he finally comes to this realization or this admission that it was not really Yosef. The Ketav HaKabbalah in Source 5, I could say what? That I or he did it. So you're saying he did it?
You could say that.
Okay.
I don't know which one, but...
Okay. No. Ki chok lekohanim me'et paro. Me'et paro. But me'et paro is a little stronger than the others. The Ketav HaKabbalah, again, this is a much later source, says that the whole thing over here about the moving populations, everything going on over here, was trying to benefit his own family. And in order to get them into this tax-exempt structure, because who had to pay? The guys who had to sell their land had to pay, so it was the landowners had to pay. So there were people who weren't landowners or people whose land was never taken, and those people didn't have to pay the 20% taxes. After working all of this out, he finds that there's a tax shelter which was built in for his for the Kohanim, and then he moves his family into the same tax shelter. If you want, I'll read it, but this is what's so interesting, is that as I'm reading through each one of the commentaries and I was preparing this week, they're all like giving me like going, like they're pulling out two thumbs, they're going like this, going like this. They're using all their Gemara logic over here to show how Yosef is outsmarting everybody. The question is, what happens when you end up long-term outsmarting everybody? But let's read this. V'nir lishit kavein b'zeto el kadua lebeit aviv. That what was the intention over here to really help the family? Let's go back another line. Admat kohanim lo biyarub farshim ha toelet bodazu. The commentaries don't tell us what is the significance of this, why we need to know this. And it even repeats it a second time. Why do we need to know this? That the whole thing over here was to create some kind of benefit for his family. When he moves the populations, that nobody is in the place that they grew up in, he emptied out Goshen, and then he put his family in Goshen, and therefore now Goshen is owned by his family because these people have all moved on. But he continues that this was a strategy which was used in ancient civilizations in order to conquer, because it also takes away, meaning there's an old adage that one person fighting for his home is stronger than I don't know how many different mercenaries who are coming and fighting to conquer it. But what if the person's no longer fighting for his home? What if there's no longer a sense of this is our homeland because you took in, you confused populations? And correct, this was done all over the place. So it's interesting that that's how they're reading in what's done over here, that these people are all moved. V'dayna yu beit aviv domim l'shar toshvei midna. One second, let's move on a little bit further. U'v'ze gam achav yechov shemimas chomesh, ki liotam ro'i tso nachashuv ma'od ve'inei mitzrayim, liot megadlim ha'behemot shehem elo hut shelahem, ki muvar b'masha kadamim, him domim z'e l'koni misharit elo heyhem. Which means essentially that the Jews are involved in something which is religious, even though it's a detestable religion for the Egyptians, but therefore he was able to create some kind of a law where there is religious exemptions, and then the brothers were able to move into the religious exemption category and not have to pay the 20% taxes because they're dealing with flocks and they're not growing things on the land. So essentially, what's fascinating, it's so modern what he's explaining, but again, the Ketav HaKabbalah is quite modern. I mean, we're dealing more with a 19th century source, but this easily could have been written by somebody today in order to show exactly how you utilize the taxes and status for religions in order to help people that you want to help. The Bechor Shor Veikra Paro Shem Yosef Tzafnat Paneach Mifaneach Hatzfunot. Yosef is the one who's able to unpack or reveal all the secrets. And she's called Asnat Bat Potiphera. Now, of course, when anybody reads this, we have to ask ourselves, and this will be debated, if Potiphera and Potiphar have any kind of similarity or don't do this. We don't care about reality now. We care about what our commentaries are telling us. So there are going to be those who are going to imagine that they are one and the same, and those who are going to say, what are you talking about? They're quite different. So let's remember something. Who was Potiphar? Potiphar was the Sar HaTabachim. Now, we've said this many times. We get fooled sometimes. You have the baker, and you have the wine steward, and then you imagine you have the butcher and the baker and the candlestick maker, but he's actually the chief executioner. Sar HaTabachim is the chief executioner. But there is this wonderful midrashic backstory that has a lot to it that fits into other things that I need to explain. When the brothers come down to Egypt, Yosef accuses them of being meraglim, and he says that Erevat Haaretz batim. You came. So the normative way of understanding Erevat Haaretz is that you came to figure out how to capture the land, which is a wonderful fantasy. You know, the 10 Jews are going to go capture the entire land, or in Vayigash, Yehuda, you have the whole backstory in terms of the Midrashim. Yehuda says, I'm going to take this house down, I'm going to kill you and your mother and your mother's family, and so on and so forth. I mean, it's just wonderful that we all felt empowered learning these things growing up as kids. I can imagine generations of Jews not in a situation that we could attack anybody, but we could then take pride in how strong Yehuda was, because Yehuda was about to do it. He was about to kill all of them, but it's a little hard to actually read, though. And when you actually read Yehuda's speech, it's one of terror and fear, and it's not, and there's bravery there, but it's terror and fear. It's not one, is, you know, another word, you know, I'm just going to kill all of you. But it's also great that Midrash, the brothers walk in, you know, they're going to take over this whole place, Meraglimatem. But there is another possibility about, there's another possibility of what Erevat Haaretz means, and that is the seedy places of town, the red light district, the other places. Now, the reason why that may fit in, and we'll see this Midrash over here, is because Yosef actually himself, we don't see him at any point being involved in heavy labor. It's interesting that in his father's house and Potiphar's house, he actually has a parallel position, which means all the others are working, but he's the one who's reporting in the house. He's the one who's in the house, and while everyone is outside in the field. Yosef is not the worker. He's not the heavy lifter. Yosef is the thinker. Yosef keeps the books, according to some. But when we're told, Yosef was the only male in all of Chumash that we're told about his looks, that he was a good-looking person. So therefore, you can say, so what's going to happen to a guy who's not strong, can't build, can't do anything, he's good-looking, so what's going to happen to him? He's going to end up in the sex trade, which essentially is what Yosef, therefore, was saying to his brothers. You're looking for somebody, but Erevat Haaretz, you're looking for somebody who you think is in the sex trade. Now, what's interesting about that is the Midrash says this. The Midrash says this regarding why Potiphar bought him, which explains a lot why Mrs. Potiphar may have been forlorn, because Mr. Potiphar was chasing after young boys. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. You don't like where this is going. No, what's interesting is that after all this happens, he says, you know what, maybe I should become a priest. Just stop. Behave. All of you behave. What can I do? Well, what can I do? These are the sources, dear. The sources speak to us. Look at the Bechor Shur. Look at source number 6 now. V'ikra paro shem Yosef tzafa paneach, mifaneach atzfunot. Ostan bat Potiphar, the one we married, upotifera upotifar echad heim. Umirov chachma lakach Yosef et bat Potiphar. Why does he marry bat Potiphar? Lafisha kanu la'eved, because this guy used to be his master. V'ima Yosef obanov yerdim migdulatam, and if something's going to happen, that Yosef becomes displaced. Now, this is really interesting, because Yosef is watching. You know what happens? One second. I think it's the Malbim said this. That Yosef is placed in the political prison, right? So what does he get in the political prison? He gets an education. He learns a lot there. He learns a lot about the inner workings of the palace. He hears all the secrets from all the people, which means, yeah, he's the revealer of the secrets. Can you imagine how much inside information he's picked up over the years by being a sounding board over there to the Sar HaMashkim and to the Sar HaRofan, and who knows how many other people are in the political prison that he's hearing everything from. He walks out of there with a doctorate in political theory and how things really work within the palace. So again, God putting him there, and maybe even needing the extra couple of years over there, going, no, you're not done yet. You still, there's more things you need to learn. You only have a master's now. You need to finish your doctorate at this point. So what does he learn while he's there? He learns that Paro one day will kick someone out and the next day bring somebody in, and Paro is completely unpredictable. And therefore, Yosef needs insurance. He needs an insurance policy. So what's his insurance policy? He marries the daughter of Potiphar right now, according to this Potiphar, because Potiphar is a pretty powerful person, and therefore, on top of all of this, Potiphar will not let his grandchildren become slaves. So really what Yosef has done is that he's put his family now into the ruling class by marrying into them. If they ever lose their position, Yomar Potiphar, Obanav ki avodim hein. Imlakach isha acheret, which means if he married someone else, so then right away, then Potiphar could be waiting there to get revenge against him. Oh, this is my former slave and so on. But now Potiphar can't do it because now he's invested in Yosef and Yosef's family because they're related. Avalhashish lakach bitam lo yerotzeshu bnei beto avadim v'chein banav al bnei amutam. So again, he has this like interesting political thinking on Yosef's part. Look at the Ramban. He starts by quoting Rashi, but Potiphera coin om. Who Potiphar? V'nikra Potiphera al shem shenistares me alav l'fisha lakach Yosef l'mishkav. So this is this midrash that he takes Yosef, and when he takes Yosef, he becomes Srisparo, which means he gets somehow turned, he loses his male vitality at that moment. God did this as a punishment, a quid pro quo, in terms of his, or midah keneged midah, he loses his ability. By the way, also according to this whole midrash, another whole midrash, that this Osnat Bat Potiphar was actually adopted, and she was the daughter of Dina when Dina was raped, and so on. No one wanted her, and she ended up going to a family where the husband is more interested in others and not interested in his wife, and therefore they end up adopting as well. I'm saying it's just part of this whole larger scheme over here. Finish the Ramban. V'hu midrash rabotenu. V'utzrach miminu Rashi lomar ki kol kohen mesharet lelohut chutz mizeh shu lashon gdula shrei sara tabachim haya. Which means Rashi is saying that, again, Rashi's working with the theory, our theory of conservation of characters, that Potiphar and Potiphera are one. So if Potiphar and Potiphera are one, I can't just say that he's a religious functionary, because a week ago he was Sar HaTabachim. So how in the world did he change from Sar HaTabachim to Kohen Own? So what's taking place? And the word Own, does the word Own have anything to do with sexuality as well? So, which is also very interesting. He's the Kohen Own, and we will leave it at that. But then the Ramban comes back, and he prefers to say, no, it could be somebody who's of religion, not necessarily somebody who's just of power. And he goes as follows. Vani omer, ki ledivra boteinu haya Potiphar sar leparo. Potiphar was a minister. V'kasher nistares begufo v'hikiru bo v'karu Potiphera nitbayesh bedavar upirish misrato. That when he got eunuched, then he left his position out of embarrassment, and then he becomes a priest, and then he becomes a man of religion. The Ramban says that that is the practice of powerful people, and it's possible that what he worshipped was owned. So this is really interesting, because he's saying it's one of the same person, but he moves from chief executioner to becoming a man of religion. And what the Ramban is telling us is that shift is not as dramatic as a shift as we would imagine. It was something which was done seamlessly. And again, let's remember, at least in the Middle Ages and moving backwards, you have the rich and the powerful, and you have let's put it this way, whatever the real estate magnates don't own, the church owns, or the other way around. And he's saying is that there was a much closer connection over here. And I don't have to say that being wealthy and powerful was as opposed to being a man of religion, because those things go together. At least not by me, perhaps, but they go together. And this is all the way through over here, is that the commentators keep on finding the brilliance in what Yosef is doing and so on. You could say that Yosef agreed and Yosef chose that one out of, again, one doesn't know, but it is interesting. Moving over towards, there's actually three different points I want to get to today. I don't know the chances of that right now. But moving to a second place, which hopefully we'll get back to the same point. We're moving backwards now. The brothers were just informed that Yosef is alive. They come to Yaakov. Ve'alumi mitzrayim ve'vor etz kanan el Yaakov avim ve'agidu lo le'mar od Yosef chai ve'chihu moshel b'kol eretz mitzrayim. Right? Not melech, moshel. Right? V'yafogli bo ki lo amin lahem, and he couldn't believe them. V'yidabru elav et kol devrei Yosef asher diber aleihem. They told over all the things that Yosef had said to them. One wonders if that is true. The Rabbeinu B'chai wonders. Look at source 9 for a second. It's called Divrei Yosef. Ein b'klalam she'agidu l'ma shamar lahem, Hashem achar t'matir mitzrayma, ki Yaakovinu lo yodev dem yolam. Remember the first thing Yosef says to them? Hi, I'm Yosef, who you sold. So when he says they told all the things, did they mention that little? I wondered the same thing when it tells us that Yaakov arrives in Laban's house and he tells him all the things that went through. Yeah, did he tell him I dressed up like my brother and I stole the brachot and so on? Or sometimes when people tell everything which happens, the everything is a selective everything. So over here as well, Rabbeinu B'chai is, and he makes this larger point, which is already made by the Ramban over here. If you're ever searching for it, this is where it is. Did Yaakov ever know about the sale? So Rabbeinu B'chai, who again, more often than not follows the Ramban, says, no, Yaakov never knew about it, and Yosef never told him, and the brothers never told him, and therefore Yaakov never knew. Anyway, back to the Pasuk, it says that he doesn't believe them, Pasuk of Zayin. He sees the wagons, and then his spirit comes back. And then, interesting, it shifts from Yaakov to Yisrael. The Yom Yisrael, Rav Od Yosef ben Ichai, El Chaverenu Beter Mamut. I'm going to go and see him. Rashi tells us that the Agalot in Source 10, that this was a sign, this was the last thing that they learned together. They were learning about Parsha Egla Arufa and so on, which is quite interesting, and one has to work very, very hard to figure out what in the world it's talking about. I believe that I do have a chapter about this called Wagons. I wrote about it. I gave a share on this a number of years ago that if you're interested, you can find, which was all about the wagons. The Rashbam says over here, it's called Divrei Yosef, V'gam ra'at agalot sheshlach Yosef al pi paro, v'tichi ruach Yaakov. So the Rashbam points out something which maybe we forgot, and that is, whose idea was to send the agalot? Again, it goes back to that same point again. It was Paro who said to send the Agalot. So that's why this is parallel. The same way that Yosef had this idea to marry Osnat, it was actually Paro who said this. And the same way that Yosef had this idea to send the Agalot, which is a sign because they were learning Egla Rufa and so on. Egla Rufa, by the way, is what happens if a person is killed and a body found in the field. So maybe all during the years, Yaakov felt responsibility because I sent Yosef away and I didn't do perhaps a proper levoy. So I'm saying the message of the Egla Rufa could be one which is much more connected to Yosef. Yosef is also called Bechor Shor. The shore is connected to Yosef and so on. And maybe there is a lot more in terms of what is the message of the Agalot, but nonetheless, all of that becomes very, very midrashic when you realize that it wasn't Yosef's idea at all. It was Paro's idea to send the Agalot. If you read the Targum Yonatan, one second, I just want to say one more thing in that Rashbam, because it connects to what we learned a couple weeks ago. V'gamrat Agalot, sheshelach Yosef Paro, v'tichi ruch Yaakov, ki shamar et tavar, shesof Yosef liot Moshe. Remember, v'aviv shamar et tavar, he always knew it's going to happen. So now, somebody is sending these Agalot, and these Agalot is something having to do with royalty in Egypt, and he had always believed that the dreams were going to come true. So the fact that the Agalot had arrived, meaning this, it's not they were learning Egla Rufa, it's the fact that there's Agalot coming, which means this is, you know, to say, you know, guess what? Your son won the lottery. He didn't win the lottery. And then a whole fleet of stretched limousines come to pick you up, which, by the way, that's what this is. He looks up and sees the stretched limousines, but it's more than that, because he always knew. He always knew. He never let go of Yosef's dreams as well. And the Rashbam says that consistently. So therefore, it's the seeing the Agalot themselves, the wagons themselves, which convince him. I'm not sure how to read the Targum Yonatan in 12, but we'll read the Hebrew in 13. V'yidiburi mo kol divrei Yosef shediberimam, v'yaret Agalot sheshlach Yosef l'sa'itoto. It's also going to be interesting what the purpose of the Agalot was. There's a little bit of debate with that. And at that moment, his prophecy returned to him. So, is this a cause and effect? Which means, when I read Rashi, he's mourning, he believes that Yosef is dead, and then, the Agalot are a symbol, and then he gets cheerful again, and then the Nevuah comes back. I read the Rashbam, he sees the fleet, and now, okay, it's true. And then the Nevuah comes back. And I read the Targum, and it may be that all this transpires, the Nevuah comes back, and then he realizes that Yosef is still alive. because he lost the nevuah during Mechirat Yosef. Again, that's what he added in over here. He lost the nevuah during the Mechirat Yosef, and now suddenly it comes back to him. So now, spiritually, he has become a changed person. So now he realizes that something else is going on in the world. So again, cause and effect over here, I think, is interesting. Just to see who it was that actually sent in source 13, if we go to page number 3, Pasuk Yud Zayin, V'yom Aparel Yosef, Emor Lachecha, Zot Asu, Tanud Be'irchem, U'lechu Bo'o Artza Kanan, U'chu Avichem Ve'et Batechem V'vo'o Alay. Now bring everybody. Ve'etna Lachem Et Tuv Eretz Mitzrayim V'chlu T'chelev Haaretz. V'ta Tzuvita Zot Asu, and he says, I'm commanding you. The problem is with the trup over here. What did it say? Are the agalot for his father as well? Unisatem et avichem. Unisatem et avichem means you're going to carry your father, or does it mean that through the agalot you're going to carry? And that is debated among the authorities, although I don't think it's as important. Pasuk Kaf Aleph. V'yesu kein b'nei Yisrael v'yitun lehem Yosef agalot al pi paro. So again, that the agalot. I just want to go back for a second. Why are the agalot important in all of this? Because the agalot are part of Paro's fleet. This is part of the military, which goes back to this question of what Yosef's power really is. Could Yosef have sent them by himself, or does he need a royal decree to be able to send this? Is Yosef on a high enough pay grade to be able to make that decision? Oh, we're sending agalot, or can only Paro do it? Why does Paro have to make this command? Yeah. It is interesting that one of the things that Paro reaches out, Yosef is very controlling, which of the brothers can see him and what they should say. They don't actually listen to him, as they never really listen to him. They can't. And it's interesting that Paro, no, maybe there's somebody else here that I can hire, which is, if one Yosef can change Egypt, imagine what a whole bunch of them can do. And he's trying to find out if there's anyone else there that he can utilize. Right, so how to read all of this becomes much more interesting. That's why I said this is connected to the previous issue. How to read all of this in terms of the larger political issues that are taking place, because again, you're talking about power, you're talking about perhaps a military fleet. And let's just take a look quickly in Rabbeinu Bachaye in 15. There was no exclusivity in Egypt. I remember when I was trying to research to what extent Egyptian mythology is connected to the various plagues, there were incredible amount of false positives because they worshipped everything. You will find that they worshipped it. It was there, they worshipped it. In Rabbeinu Bachaye in source 15, Vatatzivate Tzuveta Zotasu, Hayadu Paro Anvutunato shel Yosef, Venemunato, Shelo Yasholeach Klum Laviv Ula Echav Zoloto Mitzave Alav. Why did Paro have to command it? Because Yosef was this wonderful civil servant who never did anything without Paro telling him what to do. So again, that's interesting. In the Sforno, he writes that there was actually a law, and this is found also. Okay, he says that will be the sign because it's something royalty. The Malbim says, "Ki agalot hu tachat yad paro, v'rak ha-melech yalo yicholot l'shloach agalot, u'l'shloach agalot morash shlochim acherim sheyit yashvu sham ki ezrochei aretz b'tmidut." So again, only Paro can do this, and the Psikta writes, "Chulachem mi'eretz Mitzrayim agalot l'fishlo yirushut lotzi agalot mi'eretz Mitzrayim." Ki im al pi paro. So I'm saying you already go back, and you have various midrashim which go in this direction. The Rashbam says that as well. Reading the Hadar Zkenim, I think it's again what I had understood from the Targum Yonatan, that he saw the agalot, and at that point he believed that at that point the ruach came back. Okay, let's skip a little bit. In source 23 is when Yosef gets his appointment. That's Perek Mem Aleph. So now we're going even further backwards. And Yosef is in charge. Again, we were trying to decide what minister he was, if it was finance or agriculture or so on. We're told that he's given a merkava. He's given his own fleet, as it were. And looking at Pasuk Mem Dalet, Vayomer Paro Yosef, Ani Paro, Ubeladecha lo yarim ish et yado ve'et raglo b'chol eretz Mitzrayim. Nobody can lift their hand or leg in all of Egypt. And the next Pasuk, it says, Rikapar lo shem Yosef tzofer paneach, v'tonad asnat bat potifera, koin on le'isha. So no one can lift a hand or, now that's quite difficult to take completely literally. Yosef, every time somebody lifts a hand. So what exactly does this mean? So in the Seichel Tov, which is then going to be found in the Targum Onkelos, and Rashi will agree, take a look. Lo yirim ish et yado lechgor kli zayin ulerchov b'markavot. No one was allowed to take arms or to ride in a merkava, which is a military vehicle, other than with Yosef's permission. Which means they're reading what's Yosef's position. Now, this is interesting, because again, I don't want to be guilty of what I've been saying before. Is Yosef the Minister of Interior in Israel, who gets a gun, goes under the Ministry of Interior? But, I mean, who knows who's in charge of things then? It's an interesting position that they've put together for him. He's in charge of money, but he's also in charge of the army, which actually makes an interesting marriage when he marries into Bat Potiphar. So now you also got a guy who's got a prison and a guy who's also in charge of executions. So you're in charge of the army, he's in charge of executions. This is a really good marriage. This is a very good deal. Look at Unculus in 25. Vama paro li Yosef anaparo, right? Lo yarim gvar yat yade lemichad zain, in order to take weapons, v'yat ragle lemerkav al susya, in order to be able to ride on a horse. That it's any kind of military apparatus, no one can do without Yosef's permission. Which means Paro trusts Yosef completely, but it's completely not just financially, according to this. It's much more than this. Look at Rashi in 29. This is one of the Rashis that, you know, people don't work so hard, so they don't think, so they don't realize what he says. Ani Paro, sheyishcholet b'yadi legzer gzera al malchuti, v'ani gozer shelo yarim ish yado biladecha, shelo b'rishutcha. Look at the Targum. But what did the Targum say? Weapons. So Rashi says it, but he didn't say it. But if you don't bother learning the Onkelos, then you don't know what Rashi said. That Rashi also accepts that Yosef was in charge of the army. Yosef was in charge of all military things, which again puts Yosef's position, as I said, a little bit more interesting. And all of this, everything that I've done today, was in order to get to source number 30, which is the beginning of Sefer Shemot. V'yakam melech hadash al Mitzrayim, asher lo yada et Yosef. So now a new king comes who does not know Yosef. So my first thought of this is that that's preposterous. I know some of you know that there's a machlok in the Gemara. I know that as well. If he doesn't know or makes believe he doesn't know Yosef. So just to think about the various possibilities right now. One possibility, which historically there's what to support this with, is that the reason it isn't a Yosef is because there's a completely new regime. That Egypt was captured, Egypt was taken over, and this is a new regime, and they know nothing about Egyptian history, they don't care about Egyptian history, and therefore he has no idea who Yosef is. Okay, so that's one possibility. Another possibility is that he never knew Yosef, but he did know Tzofnat Paneach. I just have to come back to that towards the end over here, which means he knew there was a guy Tzofnat Paneach because he knows about the Egyptian history. He just didn't know who Tzofnat Paneach was, which means that Yosef's identity has been so well hidden, he has no idea that Yosef is connected to this Egyptian mythological figure, or that the Jewish people are connected to him as well. He has no idea that what he has inherited as this new Paro, the new king, is because of the Jews and because of a Jew, and therefore he has created his wealth, created his position, and he just has no idea. So again, this Yosef Tzofnat Paneach distinction is one which, as you can tell, I'm fond of, but again, one doesn't know if it's completely convincing or not. Look at, again, the Targum Yonatan, Lo Yada Et Yosef. And again, I have to remind you about something. The Targum Yonatan is 99% literal. 99% of the words, he tells you exactly what the translation is. So over here, when he says that no one can lift a hand or no one can, you know, move their legs, the reason why he told us that it was weapons is because you can't translate that literally. Because literally it didn't mean anything. He understood it's a metaphor. So anytime it's a metaphor, then he has to tell us what the metaphor means. So like in next week's parsha, we get to the brachot, which is full of metaphor. Targum Onkelos is like a different book, because it's going to be explaining metaphors and not explaining, because that's the literal interpretation, is explaining the metaphor. So you can't lift your hands. He says, no, literally that does mean that he's in charge of weapons. So over here, when it says, Lo yada et Yosef, he writes, V'kam malka chadita al Mitzrayim, d'lo mikayim gzeirat Yosef. He no longer followed Yosef's rules. Which means, Lo yada et Yosef is that we've rolled back everything that Yosef has instituted, which means, you know, the political pendulum has now swung to the other side, and everything that Yosef has now created has now been uncreated. So therefore, that really now becomes the question, because when the pendulum shifts, so now all that Yosef created, everything which at the time saved people, created wealth for Egypt and saved people's lives. What he essentially did is what people asked him to do. Please save us and do this for us and this. And Yosef acquiesces and does all these things. But now everything has moved the other way. And now the society that we lived on was created by Yosef. Again, look what he did. Not that they don't know who Yosef is, quite the opposite. They know exactly who Yosef is, but he doesn't follow Gzeirat Yosef. And now we have created an anti-Yosef sentiment, which means Yosef now has become the capitalist and the socialist, and it's both, you realize. And he has now become the person who is going to be attacked by the anti-Semites, because look what he has done to us. And everything that Yosef has done has now become bad, and now we need something which is new. The Chizkuni writes, V'kam melech, yesh mefarshim delo k'tiv mita b'melech shma minashu atzmo haya. Which means normally it says, and the king died and a new king took over. There's no death mentioned over here. And this is a pretty good point. Again, I don't have to, you know, score. This is a pretty good point in watching the Torah describe successions. And over here it just says there's a new king, but it never said that the old one died. And he's saying that's why there are those who think it's the same person still. That we're talking about like the next day. You know, Yosef has moved on, and this is the same royal house. It's not that they don't know Yosef. Shekfar elish netchav shug zerotav. Umar v'yikam shakam al Yisrael ka'ayev shenemar lo yakum rotzeach ki kamu v'yedei sheker. So what's happened now is that now Yosef has become the one who's blamed for all the problems that exist within society. The people who once owned land no longer own land. The people who have these fond memories of all the wealth that they used to have, and everything was taken by the government, and the government now plays to the other people, and the other people are saying, who's to blame for all of this? Well, there's one man to blame for all of this, and that's Yosef the Jew. Not they don't remember Tzafon HaPanach, the opposite. They remember Yosef, they remember exactly who he is, but they don't remember him fondly. And everything that we've seen now that was done, all the greatness of Yosef, is now has become an excuse in terms of hatred, and this then metastasizes into their final solution in terms of what to do with the Jews. So when we talk about unintended consequences, and we think about Yosef and, you know, in Sefer Bereishit and what great things that he did, now we have to ask, okay, so now what happened to all of this? Which means these people who were the Kohanim, they're the lords. Again, it's either religious or secular. We saw that argument. They're the lords. They're the ones of the controlling parties. These are the ones who are of power. They themselves, they retain their power. To what extent the common person can now sway Paro? So that's what becomes interesting. Because ultimately, again, think about it. Paro by himself can't do anything. Paro needs his army. Paro needs the lords, the other people of power. Paro may need the people of religion. Whether they're the one and the same or not is of less interest to us. And what ends up happening is that now there is this other group of people who are becoming more and more populated. And this group of people, when they got there, had this great position, and Yosef taking care of them. And these are all of his brothers. These are the family. These are the Jews. Now what happens as time goes on, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years go on, there's going to be a lot of resentment. Hold it. But he's living in my house. You know, he's living in my land. He's taking over my place. These people are strangers. They're not really true Egyptians. They're not really part of our culture. They really don't deserve all the same rights. It's because of these people that we got turned into slaves. We need to turn them into slaves. And you can now imagine how Yosef could have saved an entire region, not just country, entire region from a time of famine. But the thank you that we get for this is anti-Semitism, and the thanks that we get for this is that we become the victims and the and the thanks that we get for this is ultimately going to be the time of slavery. But the amazing thing is that all of this is part of God's plan, and there's still going to be a leaving Egypt, but to learn that, we need to come back and to continue.